Okay, we were last class. Did everybody drop the course after the last exam? Now everybody showed up for the last exam. 11 people were here, now there's 4. And this was the case last class too. Okay, luminescence. We talked about luminescence. Just to remind you what we talked about last class. It's light accompanying a transition from higher to lower energy state. So we talked all about absorption. So we got matter. We're talking about spectroscopy, right? So matter absorbs light. Okay, the electrons, outer shell electrons, since we're talking visible and ultraviolet radiation, the energy of that radiation corresponds to the energy gaps necessary to promote an outer shell electron to an excited state. And so the outer shell electrons go to the excited state. That's the absorption process. But now we're going to talk about the emission that can accompany that absorption. So the excited state electron then comes back down to a ground state, to an upper vibrational level of ground state, or does something giving rise to luminescence. Since what I just described to you involves photons, involves the absorption of a photon of energy to cause the excited state, that is photoluminescence. And so this slide tells us that overall the process of luminescence is light emission that comes from this transition from higher to lower energy level. It's photoluminescence if it was induced by a photon, if the excited state was generated by a photon. And there are two kinds of photoluminescence. There is phosphorescence, all right, and we'll in just a few moments we'll know more than we wanted to know about phosphorescence, or we'll know in excruciating detail what the difference is between phosphorescence and fluorescence. But they're both emission processes. They're both emission of light, excited state going to a ground state. We did say last time from the practical side of things that phosphorescence is generally exhibited by solids. I'll explain why that is as we go along. And it's exhibited by solids, so you end up with things that, you know, glow in the dark. So your basic glow in the dark stuff, you know, little toys that glow in the dark. I don't know if you have any toys that glow in the dark, but some people have toys that glow in the dark, keychains that glow in the dark, and those kinds of things. That's actually phosphorescence that's occurring. And there are other phosphorescent processes, including it mentions here CRT screens and television screens have phosphors on the back of the tube. Okay, if it has a tube, it doesn't have a tube. But if it has a tube, then it has an electron gun, a cathode ray gun, firing electrons and causing this luminescence of those materials, and that luminescence happens to be phosphorescence. In the case of the lights here, it's calcium fluoride, and it's phosphorescence. They're not really fluorescing; they're phosphorescing. Fluorescence is observable in solution, and there's a big difference in time frame. The phosphorescent things typically, or often, can have long lifetimes. So your glow-in-the-dark keychain, when you hold it up to the light, it glows for a while. Something that fluoresces, it occurs in the nanosecond time scale. Once the light is removed, within a nanosecond, it's gone. The fluorescence is gone. And so its lifetime is very short compared to phosphorescence. That's one way in which we tell the difference between phosphorescence and fluorescence. That doesn't explain to you why or what the fundamental photophysics of this process is, but that's a way to tell. And I mentioned tonic water has quinine sulfate in it, and so you see a purple glow to it, but we use it for a lot of analytical applications. All right, I also mentioned bioluminescence, chemiluminescence, triboluminescence, and electroluminescence, all different luminescence processes, all of them induced different ways. So obviously bioluminescence, biological process, firefly luciferase is the key, this is the one that everybody talks about, and you can buy firefly luciferase, the enzyme from you know, Fisher Scientific or Sigma Aldrich or whoever, and do some experiments, and people do that. Now, once you've killed the poor firefly and extracted the firefly luciferase, it's no longer bioluminescence because he's dead, okay? And it's no longer bio. Now, it becomes chemiluminescence. And so chemiluminescence is causing the excited state chemically. And bond breakage, oxidation is the usual way we do things. And then we talked about triboluminescence, mechanical excitation, or electroluminescence, electrically exciting this upper state that then comes down, giving the luminescence. Most of these, pretty much triboluminescence and electroluminescence, does not work. Most of these, they don't have any applications in analytical chemistry. Bioluminescence, not really. It's chemiluminescence does, and we can do chemiluminescence methods for measuring various compounds, but they're not anywhere near as widely used as fluorescence. Okay, fluorescence is king in terms of analytical applications of luminescence. Phosphorescence, once in a while, specific cases, a little bit more difficult to do, primarily in solids. If you want to get a solution to phosphoresce, you have to freeze it or prepare a glass. Do it at liquid nitrogen temperatures or something like that. It's just not convenient. But we'll talk more about that. Okay, so photoluminescence is the most useful, and fluorescence is the most useful of the two photoluminescence photoluminescence phenomena that I gave you. The reason many compounds exhibit photoluminescence, not all, but many, you can readily produce the effect. Okay, so you can make it happen by shining a light on something and causing it to fluoresce. And then you can control it, okay? You can control the process in several ways. The wavelength of light that you excite the excited state with helps you to control the luminescence process. Some wavelengths of light are not going to work. They're not going to be absorbed. If there's no absorption, there's not going to be any luminescence. And so the excitation wavelength is one way to control what happens. Then what we look at for the emission wavelength when it comes to analytical chemistry, right? We're going to look at a wavelength. We're going to use a particular wavelength to cause the excitation. Then we're going to observe a wavelength for the emission. Well, we can vary that wavelength and look at emission at different wavelengths, and it's going to be more luminescence at some wavelengths, less at others, none at others. And so so we can use excitation wavelength, emission wavelength. We can pulse or modulate the source. So I pulse the source, if I'm doing fluorescence, then I can see the fluorescence being given off in a pulsed fashion. So I hit it with a pulse of light, get the excited state, it gives off fluorescence in a nanosecond, maybe even picosecond time scale, depending on the particular transition, and then it's over. I hit it with another pulse, I see another pulse of luminescence. So I can pulse the system, I can actually observe the decay of the fluorescence and measure the lifetime of the fluorescence process. That's how we get those numbers like the nanosecond, picosecond values for the lifetime of the fluorescence. We know this because we can measure things on that time scale, and we can do pulsed experiments. As a matter of fact, that's one way. There are a few ways, really only a few ways, to measure the lifetime of a luminescence process. One of them is to pulse the sample, pulse the sample with some light, and then observe the fluorescence as it decays off. You measure that, it's an exponential decay, and you can measure that and determine the lifetime of the fluorescence. So it's an experiment you can do. Different things have different lifetimes. Remember we talked about charged coupled devices? You can buy something called a CCD camera. Now, I already told you that all cameras today, all digital cameras, use CCDs. Even our cell phones that are able to take pictures have a little CCD in there. But a device known as a CCD camera, a scientific device, is a charge-coupled device that has has a shutter on it. They call it a camera because it has a shutter. And it allows you to select the time frame over which you measure the light. So I can get a complete spectrum of light, but I can measure it in a certain time frame. So I hit the sample with a pulse of light. I get the excited state, and it begins to emit fluorescence. Well, I can choose the shutter speed on my CCD camera to determine that lifetime. In other words, I can wait until short lifetimes have decayed, and I can then open the shutter and measure only long lifetimes if I want to. Or I can open the shutter on my camera, right? The camera has a shutter, right? It opens the aperture, light comes in, it measures, and then the aperture closes. You control that. So I can control that to determine lifetimes. So I can measure, I can have the shutter open and close quickly and measure the picosecond range and then let all the longer lifetime things decay away and I don't measure them. Or I can delay my shutter and let the short lifetime things go away and only measure the long lifetime thing, long lifetime processes. So I can use detector, synchronized detector, or a detector that has a the ability to change its time frame in order to determine lifetimes. So I mentioned excitation, I mentioned emission, I mentioned pulsing the source, and I also mentioned using some kind of a gated detector. That's what this is. A gated detector, a shutter that only detects light of certain over certain time frames. Those are all different ways in which we can control variables that control the luminescence process. And so this is why this is an important analytical tool, because we have control over it. Bioluminescence, electroluminescence, triboluminescence, very difficult to control. Chemiluminescence, it's a little bit harder to control. I mentioned to you last class, how do you do it? Well, you could do it in a typical fluorescence instrument, but you don't turn on the source. Take your cuvette, put your sample in there, maybe the sample that chemiluminesces, and then spike in something like an oxidizing agent or whatever the chemical reaction is that causes the chemiluminescence. You put in the reagents, stir it up, put it in your instrument, and observe the luminescence that occurs without any excitation from photons. Well, that can be done. It's a little bit difficult to, you know, be spiking things in and stick it in the instrument real fast to measure this process that, since the lifetimes are on the nanosecond range, I've got to get the, it's going to be gone. If the reaction stops, the light's going to be gone. So I got to get my cuvette into the instrument before the reaction stops. Now the reaction has its own kinetics, it has its own time frame. But it makes it a little bit more difficult for me to control and utilize. But people have come up with flow injection analysis schemes where we have flowing streams, reagents flowing through tubes or tubing, and we flow them into a mixing cell and mix the two reagents, cause the reaction to occur, flow that through a detector cell of some sort and measure that fluorescence, or it's not fluorescence, it's chemiluminescence that's occurring, and so you can do it, but it's not real easy. Bioluminescence, others are basically useless analytically. Okay. All right, we're going to spend some time here on the Jablonski energy level diagram. Okay. This is the diagram. The next slide describes the processes in words. Okay, the next three slides, four slides, whatever. Okay, so I'm going to explain this. You're going to need to know this. This is, you may have seen this before in physical chemistry. Analytical chemistry is applied physical chemistry. We need to understand what's going on. This will help us understand the difference between fluorescence and phosphorescence. But we need to know how this works. So when I say need to know, that means this is going to be on the exam, right? That's what that means. Okay. All right. So Jablonski energy level diagram. We start out here at the ground state. Some people call this G. G stands for ground. Okay.
Well, you with me so far? Okay, great. So ground state. So you've got an electron in the ground state. Now, it's why is it S? Why would they call it S? Because it's a singlet state. Okay? What's a singlet state? I'm refreshing your memory. Singlet state, paired electrons. These are fingers, but if you had two electrons, they would have opposite spins if they were paired, right? They can't have the same spin. So it's a ground singlet state would be paired electrons. I hit it with light, okay? Process number one is absorption. So I hit it with some light, and one of the electrons goes to the excited state, goes up to the S1 state, the singlet excited state. First, so this is a excited. This is an electronic state, and this is an electronic state. And the electron went from the ground singlet state, paired spins, to the excited singlet state. They still got the same spins. Okay, that is the absorption process. We know all about that. We're experts on this now. Okay, now once it gets to that excited state, it can do a couple of things. Three things. One thing is, it can, well, the first thing that it always does, okay, it always does, is process number two. It's funny how I ordered those, one, two, okay. The second thing that happens is vibrational relaxation. Because, I didn't state this, I should have stated this, the ground state has vibrational levels, that's what these other lines are. The excited state has vibrational levels. This is not news to you. You saw this before, right? So we've got an electron in some. It could be in the ground vibrational level of the ground state. Okay, so it could be it's in the lowest electronic state, but it could be in any one of the vibrational levels, depending on Boltzmann's distribution, the temperature, right? Okay, so it could be anywhere down here, but this diagram shows it all the way down here. It absorbs light of some wavelength, which means some energy, and it goes to some excited vibrational level of the first excited singlet state. So it doesn't necessarily go to the ground vibrational level of the first excited singlet. It goes to some vibrational level. We don't know. Whatever. Whatever vibrational level it goes to, process number two kicks in and we get what's called vibrational relaxation. It always, 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 except when it doesn't. Always, pretty much always. There's one case, I'll give you one case where it doesn't, but pretty much always immediately relaxes to the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet. So process number two is a little squiggly line that just says, okay, wherever I end up, whether it's up here, or wherever I am, I'm going to go right back down, squiggly down, to the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet. So that's where everything starts from. Okay, that's where everything starts from. And really, we could argue that always, always, always happens. Some people say, I'll mention later, inter-system crossing to the triplet state, and some people say, well, it's possible for an upper vibrational level to couple to a vibrational level of the triplet state, and they can go back and forth between those vibrational levels. But more common is for inter-system crossing to occur from the lowest vibrational level of that first excited singlet. So, first thing that happens is vibrational relaxation, and for the purposes of what we're talking about, let's just say it always happens. Okay, so absorption followed by vibrational relaxation. Now we've got a couple of choices, okay? A couple, three choices of things that can happen. We can get process number three, which is fluorescence. I'll go in order just to help you, not confuse you completely. So I'll go in order. Process number three is fluorescence. The electron in its lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet can go to the ground state. Now it's going to go to some vibrational level of the ground state. Pick one. I'm sorry, not that one. Let's pick this one, since that's associated with process number three. It's going to go to some vibrational level of that ground state. Doesn't matter. So any vibrational level, some vibrational level. If it's fluorescence, it's going to give off light, because fluorescence is a luminescence process. So it's going to go to that ground electronic state, some vibrational level, and it's going to give off light. note, sidebar, little note on the side here. The energy, this is the energy scale over here, the energy for process number three is not the same as the energy for process number one. Process number one started all the trouble, right? Process number one was the absorption process. That has some energy. But we lost a little bit of energy because of vibrational relaxation, and we could lose a little bit more if the fluorescence process gives us the electron in some upper vibrational level of the ground state. Then we lose a little bit more energy. So process number three, its energy is not the same as process number one. It's not as large as process number one. Could process three ever have larger energy than process number one? The answer is no. Because you can't create energy. If you can create energy, come and tell me about how you're doing it, okay? And we'll make billions of dollars. Okay, if you can create energy out of nothing, you got something. But you can't do it, right? It defies thermodynamics. So, whenever energy we put in with the absorption process, whatever energy is absorbed by the absorption process, we're going to get back that either all that energy or some portion of that energy. And we're losing a little bit of the energy. Some of it's leaking out as vibrational relaxation, that lost a little, and the fact that we don't go all the way down to the lowest vibrational level of the ground state, then we lose a little there. And so process number three's energy, it's delta E from here to here, is not the same as the delta E for process number one from here, all the way up to here. Okay, now that's going to manifest, I make a point of that because that's going to manifest itself in the spectrum. It is? Yeah. Because lower energy means what? It's going to affect the wavelengths that you see. So lower energy means longer wavelengths. So the light that's absorbed is going to be one wavelength, and the light that's emitted as fluorescence is going to be longer wavelength, always longer wavelength. Can't be shorter wavelength. You'd be creating energy. You'd be getting back more energy than you put in. So it's going to be longer wavelength than the energy that was absorbed. So there's always a shift in the emitted fluorescence and phosphorescence are always at longer wavelength than the absorption. There's a shift in the spectrum. The absorption spectrum is at shorter wavelengths than the fluorescence and phosphorescence spectra. We'll see that again in a minute, but I'm emphasizing to you why that occurs according to the Jablonski diagram. Who is Jablonski? I don't know. Some Polish guy that came up with this thing. Probably came to him in a dream or something. Okay, so this is our current understanding, our current conceptual model for how this works. It's been around for a long time, 50 years, 40 some odd years or so. All right, so absorption occurs, vibrational relaxation, absorption is number one, vibrational relaxation is number two, and then we can get from the electron in this state, in the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet, we can get fluorescence. That's one of the things that can happen. We can also get process number four, which is listed here as radiationless deactivation. What is radiationless deactivation? Well, let me get my hands ready to wave and describe it for you. It is the coupling of vibrational levels from the ground state, or the lower state, whatever that is. See, there's vibrational levels, right? Well, how many of them are there? Are there only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 vibrational levels? They're all over the place, right? So these vibrational levels could go all the way up to here, and one model or conceptual way of understanding what I called radiationless deactivation, what is also referred to as internal conversion. I call it internal conversion. Internal conversion or radiationless deactivation means I couple the vibrational levels of the lower state to the upper state, and just like the vibrational relaxation occurred, vibrational relaxation relaxes me all the way down to the ground state. Okay, that's I lost all the energy. I'm an electron. Somebody gave me some energy, and I lost it all. Okay, I spent it all. Where did I spend it? I don't know. It's like a guy who goes and gets his paycheck, cashes it at the bank, puts it in his pocket, and then goes off or it doesn't have to be a guy, it could be a woman at the mall, okay? And they go off, they go, and what do? Pull out the money, spend. Oh, there's something good. I'll buy it. You know. And before you know it, it's all gone. Okay. So the electron had energy, got to the excited state, relaxed to the lowest vibrational level of the excited state, and then coupled. The coupling is probably like meeting with friends at the mall. Oh, hey, how you doing? What do you want to do? Oh, let's go out to eat. Oh, let's go buy something. Oh, let's go spend some money. Oh, yeah. And then when they're all done, it's all spent. All the energy's gone, right? So the electron coupled with other upper vibrational levels of the lower state, and this internal conversion process, or radiationless deactivation, whichever name you prefer. Radiationless deactivation is a broader term. You could lose your energy by collisions, right? You could get in your car and collide and collide with another car and lose your energy. Okay, well, the electron could collide with something and lose its energy. That's also radiationless deactivation. It doesn't involve radiation. It doesn't involve light being given off. Therefore, radiationless deactivation is a broader term. Internal conversion is a specific term that defines or describes this coupling of lower vibrational levels upper vibrationals of the lower state to the to an upper electronic vibrational levels, and the relaxation of the energy or loss of energy by a radiationless process. So that's process number four. Wow, it looks all scribbled on up here. All right, process number four. So we got one, absorption; two, vibrational relaxation; three, fluorescence; four, internal conversion, which is a radiationless deactivation process. The other thing that could happen, so we got the absorption, vibrational relaxation, electron in the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet. Several things can happen. Fluorescence, that's what we want. Internal conversion, loss of energy. Or, thirdly, intersystem crossing. Inter-system crossing. That means that there are two systems and we're going to cross between one system and the other. We're going to move from one dimension into the other. This is like science fiction, but it's not. It's science reality. Okay, so we're going to move from one dimension. What's the system? Well, this is a singlet system and this is a triplet system. So we're going to cross between systems. We're going to move from the singlet system to the triplet system. Remember the singlet system. Okay? What are these? Fingers. That's the right answer. Fingers. No. These are electrons. This is spinning one way, spinning the other way. Paired electrons, okay? And so, what's a triplet state? Forbidden. Okay? It's a forbidden state. Okay? A forbidden system. But, and certainly we can't have two electrons together that have the same spin, but we can have them like this. Okay? This one's at the excited state. It was like this. It was in the singlet system up here. Maybe I'll just draw the electrons here. Sometimes we draw them like that, little arrows, you know. Okay, that singlet. Okay, and actually it would be one this way and one this way. All right, because it was a paired system, and then we promoted one up here. Okay. Now, we get inter-system crossing. This guy crosses over, okay, goes crazy, goes wild, flips his spin, loses his mind, okay? Spinning one way, stops and starts spinning the other way. Who could know? And he was such a fine young man. So he was like this, but flipped the spin, okay? And crossed over to the dark side. No, the triplet side, okay? The triplet system. All right, so now we have inter-system crossing. We had an electron move into the triplet system. Conceptually, all that is flipping a spin. Okay, so it's forbidden, though. Not supposed to do that. No. And remember, it's putting on the brakes. It's like the Tasmanian devil. You know, the Tasmanian devil spins around. And then he stops, and then he spins the other way. That's what the electron has to do, right? It has to flip its spin. So, the triplet system is now an electron, let's see, spinning this way, and this one in its pair, its partner is down there, but it's got the same spin. Okay, that's not right. They're not supposed to have the same spin. So, but that's intersystem crossing. Now, this diagram shows it as a downhill process. But other diagrams you may see, other Jablonski diagrams, will show more vibrational levels all the way up to here, and it'll show a direct crossover at the same energy. I prefer that, but this is a cleaner, nicer diagram for you to see. There are many Jablonski diagrams out there. As a matter of fact, there's a link in this lecture to a website that's animated, and it shows you the electron going up and vibrationally relaxing and going down and giving off light as fluorescence or phosphorescence, you know, all those. And you can go there and, you know, when you're bored, and watch the electron move around. Okay, but the point is that it can be at the same energy, because in one of our processes, which I'll get to in a few minutes, process number 8, which I don't even have listed on the slide at the bottom, that's delayed fluorescence. That's where an electron goes, flips its spin, goes over to the triplet state, and then says, I've been a bad electron, I got to go back to the way I'm supposed to be, and comes back over to the singlet state, okay, and then gives off fluorescence. But that process takes time, and the fluorescence, therefore, is delayed. It doesn't immediately manifest itself. You don't see the fluorescence immediately. You see it later. And so, because it's a delayed fluorescence, but it's still fluorescence, okay? So it is a crossover and back. And you couldn't have lost energy. If you lost energy down here, you can't go back up here. You can't gain energy to go back up there. So it has to be at the same level. So anyway, that's my discussion of this little squiggly line. So number 5 is intersystem crossing, the spin flip, okay, going over to the triplet state. So now, once I get the triplet state, so those were the three things that happen once you get that electron in the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet. First two things that happen are absorption, got to have that or you got nothing. So you get absorption to get the excited state. Then you get vibrational relaxation, and we said that just always occurs. And then we have three things that can happen. Fluorescence, internal conversion, which is radiationless deactivation, or intersystem crossing. Once you get intersystem crossing to the triplet state, then two things can happen. You can also get internal conversion or a radiationless deactivation process, number 7. So I lumped 4 and 7 together. 4 and 7 are the same, but one's in a triplet state and one's in a singlet state. And then, the second thing that can happen is the phosphorescence process. Actually, there's probably, we could say, a third thing that can happen, and that would be the passing back over to the singlet state and the delayed fluorescence. But anyway, so we've got 7. Process number 7 is loss of energy, going back to the ground state without giving off light, internal conversion, which is radiationless deactivation, and so that can happen. Get nothing out of that. Or number 6, process number 6 is actual phosphorescence. And phosphorescence, again, we described it before as luminescence with a longer lifetime, and doesn't happen as often. Usually only happens in solids or frozen liquids or something like that. And several things about that. It's less energy. Why? Well, the triplet states are usually what are referred to as lower lying triplets. Their energy is lower. So if so actually what's not shown here is vibrational relaxation. If the electron comes over and it relaxes down to the lowest vibrational level of the triplet state, then my delta E for process number 6 is going to be really small compared to the absorption and compared to the fluorescence. It's a small energy, so it's even longer wavelengths. And so that phosphorescence process is going to have a small delta E, longer wavelength transition, or light's going to come out in longer wavelengths. So we're going to see that. We're going to see lower energy, we're going to see longer lifetimes, okay? That's about it. Okay, so we've got those six processes, seven actually, and then number eight was cross back over and give fluorescence. It's fluorescence if it's a singlet process, if the spins are paired, and so the spin flipped to go to triple state, then came back, flipped again, and paired spin situation, and goes to the ground state, and we get delayed fluorescence. The ground state is a singlet state, so when the triple state goes down to the singlet state, it's flipping its spin back down. It's flipping its spin the right way, okay, so it can pair up with the other electron. Does that all make sense?
When it converts from the duplex to singlet, is there any energy loss?
Well, no. And it'll either be at the same energy, okay? It's always going to convert at the same energy. Even this one is misleading because most diagrams that you see will show, or many diagrams that you'll see will show same energy. What they've done is they've combined two things. They've combined the inner system crossing, which has no energy change directly associated with it, and then the vibrational relaxation, which we called process number two. They've combined those two things in number five. They combined inner system crossing and vibrational relaxation together.
Do you think that is a longer time process?
A longer time process.
Yeah.
But not energy. She asked about energy. Well, yeah, it's a forbidden system, right? We've got paired spin, or unpaired spins, or spins that are the same. Right, and it's very unlikely for this to happen. That's something else I should have thrown in. It's on the next few slides, and that is, it's less likely for that to occur. It's forbidden. It's not supposed to happen. You're not supposed to have spins that are the same. So it's going to be a less likely, less probable transition, or a less probable process to occur. Therefore, you're going to see phosphorescence a lot less often than you see fluorescence. Okay? All right, we're going now. In words, the same thing in words, but you've been using words. Well, I use a diagram, but I just want you to see. Absorption occurs, process number one. Then things start to happen. Vibrational relaxation was process number two. Upper vibrational levels lose the energy, go to lowest vibrational level of that excited state. And it's a very fast process, 10 to the minus 12th seconds. And it's process number two on our diagram. Internal conversion, which I told you about but didn't label on the diagram, is that non-radiative process, which I refer to as VR, vibrational relaxation, and it is vibrational relaxation, but vibrational relaxation is a broader term that covers other things as well. And so that's process number four, and it's excited state ground, the electron in the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet couples to upper vibrational levels of the ground state and relaxes, and so we lose the energy. Okay, then because the process number two, where everything ends up in the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet, then those electrons can do three things. We said number one, so it says here, all absorbed photons result in promoted electron ending up in the lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet. So they always end up there. Then three things can happen. Fluorescence, transition to the ground state, some upper vibrational level of the ground state, followed with loss of energy as light. So we see the light. It's fluorescence. The second thing that can happen is we can have that radiationless deactivation or internal conversion process. Since I used the term radiationless deactivation, the reason, and I mentioned this, there's also collisional deactivation. Well, that would have to lump under there as well. So it could bump into something else and lose its energy. All right, but if we're just talking the photophysics, then it's the coupling and the internal conversion process, the coupling of the upper vibrational levels and losing its energy that way. If it's a collisional thing, then we can lose energy that way. But that's all process number four. And then number five is inner system crossing, lowest vibrational level of the first excited singlet, couples to some upper vibrational level of the triplet state. Now, that wasn't really shown in the diagram. It just showed it zipping down in process number five, which was combining those two things. So upper vibrational level of the triplet state followed by vibrational relaxation. So these two things were together, number five, okay, the inner system crossing and vibrational relaxation. Once that lowest vibrational level of the triplet state is formed, it can do two things. It can phosphoresce, or it can have internal conversion, vibrational relaxation type process, again, that radiationless deactivation type system. So we said phosphorescence was number six, and I didn't tell you number seven and eight, but I explained those on the diagram. Okay, transition from the triplet to the singlet ground state with emission of a photon is spin forbidden. The spin has to flip to get to the ground state. Okay, low probability, slow rate. Okay, fluorescence is a spin allowed transition. Sorry, like this. Okay, excited states like this, up and down. That's allowed. That's okay. And so very probable, very fast rate, very short lifetime, typically in the nanosecond range, can be picosecond, can be in the hundreds of picoseconds. So probably 100 picoseconds to 20 nanoseconds is probably the full range of lifetimes for fluorescence in that range, okay? Phosphorescence, since it's spin forbidden, is not so probable, slower rate, longer lifetime, anywhere from millisecond, okay, 10 to the minus 4th seconds, right? That's not right. That should be 10 to the minus 4th. Okay. Not 10,000 seconds. Okay. So fix that on your slide. 10 to the minus 4th second, so millisecond, sub-millisecond range. But well separated from fluorescence. Fluorescence is nanoseconds, upper tens of nanoseconds at the high end. This is tenths of milliseconds. It's upper microsecond, hundreds of microseconds, all the way up to 10 seconds. Long lifetime. That's real long, 10 seconds, okay? So we can obviously easily distinguish between those. The fluorescence and phosphorescence lifetimes are well resolved and easy to distinguish. It's not like a continuum of lifetimes. Hey, there's my fingers. I mean my electrons. Okay? Singlet ground state, singlet excited state, triplet excited state. Okay? I'm not even going to try. Go to that website if you like, and you can look at that little animation of the, and it gives all those processes and shows you what with animation, the electron being absorbing light, going to the excited vibrational level, vibrational relaxation, and then fluorescence, vibrational relaxation, inner system crossing, phosphorescence, all those things. And you get to choose a couple of things on there, and then they mail you $1 million in the mail. You still wouldn't go there, would you? No. Okay. Anyway, all right. Let's talk about spectra. Since we've been talking about absorption spectra, we got to talk about emission spectra. And I'm going to tell you about five different kinds of spectra. Five, yeah. Unless there was another one after that. No, there's only five, I think. So, what kinds of spectra can we have? Well, if we're talking about luminescence, and that's general topic, luminescence, we can have, and actually specific, the photoluminescence. So, photoluminescence. Okay, so photoluminescence spectra. Well, first of all, you can have an excitation spectrum. So there are some wavelengths of light that will be absorbed and cause some luminescence. Some wavelengths of light will cause no some wavelengths of light will not be absorbed. Some wavelengths of light will be absorbed, but the energy will be lost by one of those non-radiative processes that we talked about, collisions, internal conversion, whatever, or lost to a triplet state, which then lost its energy somehow. So the excitation spectrum is not always the same as the absorption spectrum, although there is a correlation between the absorption spectrum, the UV visible absorption spectrum that you get with a UV visible absorption instrument, and the fluorescence excitation spectrum. They both involve the same process. It's process number one on our Jablonski energy level diagram. So they both involve the same process, so there's a correlation. So why aren't they exactly the same? Because we're measuring luminescence in this case, now, today, in this part of the course. We're doing emission techniques. We're measuring the light that's emitted. So, but in the absorption case, the UV visible molecular absorption situation, we were measuring the light that was absorbed. We would see all light that was absorbed. Doesn't matter what happens to it after it's absorbed, we measure it all. So in the absorption case, we'll have a spectrum. We'll say we have several peaks in it. Then we take the same molecule and we put it in a fluorescence emission instrument, and we measure the excitation spectrum, and we see a couple of peaks in the excitation spectrum that correspond exactly to wavelengths that were in our absorption spectrum. There's a correlation. But we don't see all the peaks. And the reason we don't see all the peaks is because some of the peaks in the absorption spectrum do not give rise to emission. They've lost their energy some other way rather than by giving off a photon. So there's a correlation, okay, but you don't see all of the peaks in the excitation spectrum that you see in the absorption spectrum. Okay, is that clear as mud? Okay. Excitation spectrum fluorescence or phosphorescence intensity is measured. You measure the intensity of the luminescence, fluorescence or phosphorescence, at some fixed wavelength normally, but we do it as a function of the excitation or absorption. Okay, excitation is absorption. Excitation comes about because of absorption. So we measure the wavelengths of light that we are shining onto the sample. So we have a source, a monochromator, that selects the light first, and then we only allow certain wavelengths of light to shine on the sample. Normally we scan sequentially. We start at 200 nanometers and we scan to 600 nanometers and we shine that light sequentially, different wavelengths of light, on the sample and cause whatever processes will occur, whatever absorptions will occur. And if we're measuring an excitation spectrum, we only see those that will give rise to emission, luminescence of some sort. Okay? That's an excitation spectrum. Fixed, the emission is fixed, but the excitation is being scanned. Now we're going to reverse that. If we were going to measure an emission spectrum, there are two kinds that are very much like what we just did. There's a fluorescence emission spectrum in cases where we have fluorescence. There's phosphorescence emission spectrum in cases where we have phosphorescence. In essence, they're done in essentially the same way. We can distinguish between the two, but with a conventional instrument, we would see both. Okay, we would see both fluorescence and phosphorescence at the same time. I'll explain that in a little bit more detail in just a minute, but let's explain how we do the experiment. We did our excitation spectrum a minute ago. We found out that the sample absorbs and emits based on a certain wavelength or certain wavelengths. Let's say it absorbs light at 300 nanometers and it gave us some emission. So now I'm going to fix my excitation wavelength at 300 nanometers. So I dial in 300, my source, my monochromator there, and I dial in on the monochromator such that it selects just 300 nanometer radiation to shine on my sample. I then scan my emission. I look at the light that's emitted from the sample, okay, and I scan that. I scan that monochromator, which then the light passes through that monochromator to my detector, to my little photomultiplier tube, more than likely. and I look at the luminescence that occurs. Is there any at 200 nanometers? 201, 202. And I scan all the way up, and I look at the emission coming off of that sample at all the different wavelengths of light. And I get an emission spectrum with a fixed excitation. Okay, that's the normal way to do it. Fixed excitation, scan, see emission at various wavelengths. Okay, when that occurs, I have an emission spectrum. I can't really tell, based on the experiment I described to you, whether it's fluorescence emission or phosphorescence emission. Now, if it's a solution that I have in a little cuvette, it's probably fluorescence. It's unlikely that it's phosphorescence, because that's usually solids. The experiment's done at right angles. I shine the light this way. I observe the light at a right angle. It doesn't have to be at right angles, but it's an easy configuration because the source light doesn't get into my monochromator for my emission, and I don't accidentally measure source radiation. And I can easily distinguish between the light's source and the light emitted from the sample. So that's a convenient arrangement. But it could be any wavelength, any geometry. It doesn't have to be... If I did it at 180, like I do my absorption experiment, I might have trouble. I might not. I might have trouble. So I can do it at any geometry, but 90 degrees is the normal fluorescence geometry. Okay. That's my emission spectrum, and I have fluorescence separated from phosphorescence. How would I distinguish phosphorescence from fluorescence? Well, so far, the only thing we said is, well, there's different wavelengths, but we're scanning wavelengths, so, you know, how do we know? Time is the way to distinguish fluorescence from phosphorescence. There are many schemes by which you could do it. One way to do it is with a chopper. That's like a motorcycle? No, that's not a motorcycle. A chopper is a wheel. I think I've described this for you before. A wheel that that has a hole in it, and it spins in front of the it spins in the light path. And when the hole gets by the light beam goes through. And when the rest of the disc is in front of the light beam, it blocks it off. So I would be able to distinguish between processes that are instantaneous or nanosecond versus processes that are slow, that are occurring after I. So let's say I. Let me further explain how this is done. I shine my light. I get absorption and all the things that go on. I get fluorescence or phosphorescence. Let's say if it's fluorescence. And I put my little chopper thing in front of the excitation source, I block it off, or I allow it to go through the hole and excite. If I measure light, even after the light's blocked off, it's probably phosphorescence because it's long-lived, and it continues to emit even after the light's blocked off. If it's fluorescence, I block off the light, and within nanoseconds, it's gone. But in the case of phosphorescence, it continues for maybe seconds. So I can tell by that little chopper experiment, by putting a little wheel with a hole in it in front of the light and spinning it. And as that spins, I alternate between blocking off the light and letting the light through. And if the emission continues beyond nanoseconds, and again, you can't spin a wheel like that very fast, so you would not be able to see nanosecond emission. It would be blocked off, or it would immediately decay away when the light is blocked off. Long-lived processes like phosphorescence would continue to emit, and so that's how we tell the difference between fluorescence and phosphorescence. Now, the little chopper thing is called a phosphoroscope, and there are many permutations of that wheel. Some of them, one I saw is like a can. It's like you take a cylinder, and you cut a couple of holes in the cylinder, and you put that around your sample, and you spin it. And sometimes, when the hole is by the light source, it allows the light to hit the sample, and then it rotates around. And when the hole is by the detector, it allows the light to come out. So if the process is long-lived, the light goes in through the hole rotates around, and the light comes out. And it has to be able to, the process has to be able to sustain its emission throughout the time frame for that opening to rotate all the way around to the detector. If it doesn't, it's fluorescent. If it doesn't last, it's fluorescence. If it's a fast process, it's fluorescence. If it's a slow process, it's phosphorescence. All of that is done, but we're scanning the emission monochromator and we're getting a spectrum. Okay, we have a couple of spectra on the next. We have three spectra. We have the three that we just talked about: the excitation spectrum, the fluorescence spectrum, and the phosphorescence spectrum. There are not many compounds that you could do this experiment with, but the polyaromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, or sometimes people call them PNAs, polynuclear aromatics. Okay, this is one. This is phenanthrene, right? Naphthalene, anthracene, benzoapyrene, all those polyaromatic hydrocarbons. Okay, they all fluoresce. Why do they fluoresce? Because they have pi electrons. Okay, pi electrons that can pi to pi star transitions are good candidates for fluorescence. And so we get pi to pi star. Remember that stuff? Or did you not watch the video yet? You better watch that video. You're going to be in big trouble if you don't watch that video. I'm telling you. I may make the whole test on that video. Anyway, these give off fluorescence and phosphorescence, luminescence. So here's the excitation spectrum. So 200 to 300 nanometers. Okay, you get a couple of peaks, a little bump there too. Then, and again, that doesn't tell you, but that would be at some fixed emission. So the emission wavelength. Emission lambda. I don't know what it is, but there had to be some emission wavelength that this was measured at while we did the excitation scanning. Then, holding the excitation at some one of these values, probably this one, but could be that one, we then scan the emission, and we would see fluorescence and phosphorescence. Okay, and they're shifted in wavelength because of the Jablonski diagram delta E's, right? The delta E for fluorescence was lower than the absorption, and the delta E for phosphorescence was lower than the fluorescence, which is lower than the absorption, okay? So they're increasing wavelength because longer wavelengths are less energy. So phosphorescence is out here, fluorescence is here. The way they would distinguish this phosphorescence from the fluorescence would be by some kind of phosphoroscope, some kind of chopper, rotating can, or today nobody would build a mechanical device anymore. They all build everything electronic. So they would build some kind of a device that would electronically gate the detection and allow you to distinguish between fluorescence and phosphorescence. Okay, so this is those are the kind of spectra that you typically see. This is classical luminescence, photoluminescence spectroscopy. Right? Now, there's a couple of more types of spectra that you can measure. Oh, well, I'm not quite done yet. Fluorescent and phosphorescent spectra at longer wavelengths. Already said that. The delta E that is from S1 to S0. That was first excited singlet to the ground state, or G, is smaller than the absorption. Okay, so that's fluorescence. S1 to S0 is fluorescence. That's smaller than the delta E for the absorption, S0 to some upper vibrational level of S1. Okay, so that's always lower. Degree of structure in fluorescence spectrum is due to the degree of solvation as discussed for absorption. So before I said that when molecules are solvated, they interact with the solvent. So a molecule gets solvated, it dissolves, and there's solvent molecules all around it that are interacting with it electronically, by dipole moments, by van der Waals forces, by London dispersion forces, by all those things that we talk about molecules interacting with one another. What does that do? That perturbs energy levels, broadens them, and so forth. And that's why we don't get sharp lines in our molecular spectra. Now, the polyaromatics, like the phenanthrene that we just looked at, is a rigid molecule, flat as a pancake. Right? Those benzene rings are fused together. It's a planar molecule. Naphthalene is a planar molecule. What about biphenyl? Rotates around the bond right here, right? Okay, it's moving. That's not the same. It's rotating, right? Those two benzene rings are spinning around like fan blades on a fan, right? They're spinning, okay? Rotational energy. But the polyaromatics can't do that. There are no bonds at which they can rotate around. They're naphthalene, anthracene, phenanthrene, all those fused ring aromatics are flat, rigid molecules. They have translational energy. They can move around in the solution, but they can't rotate. There's no rotational energy, or there's no way for them to rotate. So they interact less with the solvent, and they're nonpolar. Nonpolar things interact a little bit less anyway than polar things that have, you know, lone pair electrons or things like that. So they don't interact as much with the solvent. Therefore, we don't see loss of energy, we see lines, or they're not lines, but we see sharper bands rather than broad, really broad bands in the spectra of these kinds of molecules. Right? So we see, look at this, we see, you know, those are almost lines, right? Those are fairly narrow bands. And so those fairly narrow bands come about because of the rigidity of the molecule and its inability to interact with the solvent very well. Also, it allows us the one of the reasons I didn't tell you this, I don't think, probably unless I forgot, unless it was on the slide and I forgot to tell you about it. Phosphorescence, when I told you it had a longer lifetime, one of the problems with phosphorescence is because of the long lifetime, if a molecule is emitting over a long period of time, it can collide with other molecules. And if during that emission process it collides, okay, it's going to lose its energy. If it loses its energy, you're not going to see the emission. And so, phosphorescence is not as observed as often because it has a long lifetime and is subject to collisional deactivation or other deactivation processes that rob it of its energy and its ability to luminesce. So I went back to look at that. So these are things that are going to affect our manifestation, what we see as a phosphorescent spectrum. Okay, what we see is going to be affected by the fact that this is a long-lived process, this phosphorescence, and it may lose some of its energy. It's only going to occur in rigid molecules or molecules that are in the solid state where there's no collisions, right? Solid state, there's nobody colliding. In solution, they're colliding, they're moving around, and they're bumping into each other. So you don't see it much in the solution phase. If you do see it, it's because the molecule is rigid and is not able to lose it through various vibrational relaxation processes. But polyaromatics are somewhat unique in this way, not completely unique, but somewhat unique, and so we see phosphorescence from them. Okay, degree of structure is due to degree of solvation. We said that rigidity of molecule and its inherent lack of interaction plays a role in the spectrum as well. Okay, I was going to tell you about two more kinds of spectra, I told you. Excitation emission matrix. Now, What is an excitation emission matrix? It's the same thing that we talked about before, only more of it. Okay? If I were to, I told you, if we do an excitation spectrum, we fix the emission wavelength and scan the excitation. If we were to do an emission spectrum, we fix the excitation wavelength and scan the emission. Well, why not scan both? Why not set the value of the excitation at 200? This is excitation, and that's 200. It's a little messy. One of my graduate students did this. Excitation fixed it at, I'm sorry, my eyesight's bad. 200 nanometers, excitation, and then scan the emission over all these wavelengths. Okay? Increment the excitation to 205, whatever it is, and scan the emission. Increment the excitation to 210, scan the emission. Increment it to 215, scan. 220, 225, scan, scan, scan. 250, scan. 300, scan. Okay? So all I'm doing is I'm changing the excitation wavelength, and then I'm doing a scan. That's why there are these lines like this across this spectrum. Okay? Whoops. So what I've done is I do a three-dimensional matrix of excitation on one axis, emission on the other axis, and fluorescence on the z-axis. X, Y, Z. Three-dimensional matrix, but it's the same. It's the same experiment. Okay, in other words, it's the same luminescence I'm looking at. I'm just looking at all possible wavelengths that we could have excitation and emission occurring in this system. Now, if you're clever and you're looking and you're saying, what's going on back over here? There's a mountain right here. There's a little ridge right here. There's a bump over here. Okay? But what's going on back over there? The answer is absolutely nothing. Okay? And the reason is because values that occur back here are values where the excitation wavelength is longer than the emission wavelength. That means that the excitation wavelength is at lower energy than the emission wavelength. Well, that can't be. You will never see a process where the emission is at higher energy than the excitation energy that you're putting in. Because remember, if you can do this, okay, we need to talk, okay? We'll make billions, maybe trillions, okay, if we can make energy, okay? If we can make energy out of nothing, right? Create energy, defy thermodynamics, then we're going to be multi-billionaires. But we can't do it. Right? It's a fundamental law. It cannot be altered. It's immutable. So, back in the back section, the back half of this EEM, this excitation emission matrix, has wavelengths where nothing can occur because the energy that I'm putting in for excitation is less than the energy of the wavelength that I'm looking at and trying to see emission. But I can't see emission that's going to be greater in energy than the energy that I put in, so it's never going to occur. So I won't see anything in that back section. That whole back section is flat. And you can set your instrument up and put it at those wavelengths. Set it for 300 nanometer excitation and 200 nanometer emission. But you're never going to see 200 nanometer emission from a 300 nanometer excitation because it's more energetic emission, and you can't see emission at higher energies. Okay, so an EEM is done by sequentially scanning. Now, if I have a photodiode array or a charge-coupled device instrument that measures the spectrum in a split second, a millisecond, and I set the excitation wavelength to some value, and it instantly measures the spectrum, then I can do this pretty fast. I can increment my excitation and measure spectra one right after the other. And you can buy an instrument, you pay a lot of money for it, but you can buy an instrument that has a charge coupled device or a photodiode array as a detector, measures the complete spectrum in a fraction of a second, and then all you got to do is change your monochromator to increment that excitation wavelength, and in a few minutes, you can have the complete spectrum. Okay? We don't have one here with a photodiode array. A friend of mine at Tufts University has one, and we have a collaborative project, and we're looking for students to do some work on this luminescence, okay? Measure excitation and emission spectra of compounds, and then do some sophisticated math on the peaks that you get, okay? All right, let me point out one more thing, and that is, you see this little ridge right here? Remember the second order effects that we talked about that everybody got wrong on the exam? Maybe you don't remember. Maybe it's just a bad memory. Second order effects. That's when you, when in a monochromator that's based on a grating, not on a prism, but on a grating, because of the interference, the diffraction interference process that gives rise to a spectrum in a grating monochromator, you have 300 nanometer radiation and 600 nanometer radiation both. Okay? Well, that's what that is. Okay? So what this is the monochromator gives me a if I have a process occurring at 300 nanometers, I'm going to see a little peak at 600 nanometers. Okay? It's a second order phenomenon. The most embarrassing thing is I found in the literature it's an old paper back in the 1960s or something, where somebody published and they said, look, we found a new feature in the spectrum of this molecule. It was just a second order. They just didn't know what they were doing. And it actually made it into the literature. Anyway. Okay. So that's an EEM. This is another way of looking at an EEM. That was a profile where you could see the mountain range and the plateaus and the plains and so forth. Well, this is a contour plot of the same thing. This is looking straight down. So this is X and this is Y, and Z is represented by these contours. Okay? So this would be a peak and this would be a peak, and these would be lower and lower and lower going down this way. Okay? Same thing, just looking at it in a different representation. Okay? EEMs represented as contour plots. The last kind of spectrum, no applause please, the last kind of spectrum that we're going to talk about is a synchronous scan spectrum. That's where, rather than, even in the EEM, I held the excitation and scanned the emission. Then I incremented it and scanned, increment and scan. In a synchronous scan, we scan both, excitation and emission at the same time. Now, there needs to be an offset, right, because there's a delta. There's a delta E, a delta in energy between the excitation and emission. So I need to be looking at longer wavelength emission than excitation. So I put a delta in there. That delta, in this case, it's a delta 25 nanometers. Okay? There's a 25 nanometer difference between the excitation and emission, but I'm scanning both of them. So I set my up my instrument, and I my excitation is 300 and my emission is 325. That's where I start. And then I scan both of them. Excitation is 301, emission is 326. 302, 327. You know, all the way down. Always 25 nanometers apart. Well, what's the purpose of that? Okay. Well, the purpose of that, by the way, that experiment is a... Look at it this way. Here I have these linear cuts, so you can see the scans, you can see the lines. Well, a synchronous scan is a diagonal cut. Let's see, which diagonal would it be? This is kind of backwards, but anyway, it would be a diagonal line across this. Rather than going this way, I would just be going diagonally across. That's all you're doing when you're doing a synchronous scan. You could change the delta and get different diagonal cuts across this spectrum. So a synchronous scan is just a diagonal cut. Now what it does is it emphasizes the features in the spectrum. It's not widely done, but it's picking up popularity, particularly for complicated systems. Natural products, biological systems, we have mixtures of things that have fluorophores. When you do a synchronous scan, you're able to sort of isolate some of those species, because there'll be some wavelengths that'll be really good for fluorescence of some compounds and bad for others. And so you're able to accentuate or better resolve features by doing a synchronous scan. Okay. I wonder how many slides I have. Probably hundreds more. Fluorescence efficiency is an important parameter, and let me just tell you about this before you go. Fluorescence efficiency is simple. It just says the number of photons that are emitted versus those that are absorbed. So what happens to the photons that are absorbed and don't get emitted? Well, there's radiationless deactivation and collisional things and all those inter-system crossing and all that other stuff that doesn't give you light. Well, we can write rate constants for everything. So this quantum yield or fluorescence efficiency, number of photons emitted versus number of photons absorbed, you can say, okay, it's caused by fluorescence. It's the things that are absorbed that don't give me fluorescence, or the things that are absorbed can give me fluorescence. They can give me internal conversion. They can give me inter-system crossing. They can give me all sorts of things that occur. So the things on top give me fluorescence. And the things on the bottom everything's on the bottom. All the possible processes are on the bottom. And actually there are more than just these three, but these are the three main ones, and the ones that we talked about. Fluorescence, internal conversion, and inter-system crossing. So it's just the rate of each, or the rate of fluorescence divided by the rate of all the others. The ones that are the largest are going to win. Okay, the ones that are largest are going to dominate in the system. It is the lifetime, since these are rates, these are k's, then the lifetime is the reciprocal, or it's the reciprocal of the lifetime are the rates, or the rates are the reciprocal of the lifetime. So the rate of fluorescence, rate of radiationless deactivation or internal conversion, rate of inter-system crossing, and the fluorescence lifetime are related, okay, because this is a rate per second. This is seconds, okay? Lifetimes are in seconds. How many nanoseconds, picoseconds, milliseconds, whatever, all right? Then the lifetime is related to those rates of those different processes. Okay, we'll talk more about that next time and more about the practical aspects of fluorescence.